Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
For the Australian public to engage with these debates, they need to see their political leaders arguing about it. It can't just be the preserve of the security community deciding what's right for the country.
I felt that this document in its entirety, while yes, acknowledging the mammoth effort in the shorter time frame, it's commendable, but I think it misses the complexity of the strategic environment.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm David Andrews. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Buchanan, an Australian geopolitics expert, an expert associate here at the National Security College, and Dr. Andrew Carr, a senior lecturer in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU, to discuss Australia's new national defence strategy. Welcome, Liz and Andrew.
Thanks, David.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Australia's new national defence strategy that was released last week on the 17th of April by Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence Richard Marles. In this document, the government lays out plans to invest an additional $5.7 billion in defence over the next 4 years, and with plans to invest an additional $50.3 billion over the next decade to implement its new strategic concept of national defence through an approach centred on denial and deterrence. Now, lots of other podcasts have gone into detail on the technical ins and outs and budget details and capability details, but can I just start with asking you both what your initial impressions on the NDS were? And are there things that you think it did well? Are there areas you think it's lacking? Perhaps, Andrew, I can start with you.
Thank you, David, and thanks for the chance to be on the show. So I think first we should start by acknowledging that it's a major effort to get a big document like this done in just a year's time. That's rare in Australian kind of history, that occasionally governments have thought about trying to do more regular reviews, but our strategic basis papers and our defence white papers were generally on ad hoc 3 to 5 year cycles. So committing to do it biannually for these new national defence strategies and doing the first one within a year has been a massive effort. And hopefully this new approach will provide kind of more regular and structured approaches to doing these documents. And that, I think, is a useful change that the DSR brought in. There's a lot of continuity from the 2023 Defence Strategic Review, particularly around this idea of a focused force and the role of the scenarios in driving a lot of what defence is doing. And I think that's really, for me, the kind of core strategic logic and the part that if you're not really paying attention to, a lot of the different pieces in it don't make sense. The other part I would kind of was noticed or kind of thought was very significant was that we're backed in some ways to a kind of two-tier approach, in that there is a kind of focus on areas immediately close to Australia, a kind of policy that I've been calling archipelagic deterrence, and then there is a broader kind of regional reassurance focus. Now, they're all kind of described under the heading of deterrence, but, you know, understanding those distinctions, I think, is really crucial as well for kind of assessing what's trying to be done and how they're attempting to do it.
Thanks very much. Liz, how about you?
Thanks, David. So I had three big takeaways after consuming the document. The first one was there's no real evident clarification around to what effect we're trying to generate here. And for me, that's a huge problem from the outset. I also, I guess, as my kind of polar nerd hat on here, it was concerning for me to not find any boundaries or definitions when it came to defending Australia and this concept of defence of Australia. Obviously, we've dropped off the terminology around Australian territories, of which we have quite a bit of it. The second broader issue, which would be cool to unpack as well, was I wonder if the strategy of denial is at odds with the fundamentals of deterrence. So for me, if we're denying, I kind of wonder if we've already failed to deter. So this idea that deterrence is fundamental to national defence, as it's termed in this document, I wonder how the strategy of denial kind of fits there, and is that something that's unresolvable? The third broad takeaway I've got as well was I felt that this document in its entirety, while yes, acknowledging the mammoth effort in the sort of shorter time frame, it's commendable, but I think it misses the complexity of the strategic environment. And, you know, yes, it is competitive, and yes, it's more fraught with challenge and risk than any other time since the end of World War II. But complexity isn't always taking us to war. So I do kind of wonder about the strategic environment judgments that have been used. In chapter one, there was a point made about the National Defence Strategy had reaffirmed judgments made in the 2020 DSU. And for me, four-year-old judgments are kind of problematic to be underpinning this new broad national defence strategy upon. And also there was further kind of vignettes of this, I guess, aged strategic assumptions that were when it came to discussions about strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific, you know, quote unquote, there's increasing competition to access strategic ports through the Indian Ocean. Well, yes, but any, you know, Australian expert of any of the Indian Ocean Rim countries would tell you, you know, specific to China, of course, that the foothold of these countries in strategic ports throughout the region is something that's not new and it's already, you know, well established.
Could I maybe just pick up on one of those points you made there, Liz, about the question of complexity not taking us to war? Could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So I just think this binary setting, which, you know, jumped out to me from this document of things are all headed in a really problematic direction, and that direction is all-out conflict. I understand that, I mean, with the strategy of denial, I do wonder, you know, who has read within the department who was writing this strategy. Bridge Colby, who's a dear mentor of mine, but Bridge Colby's text called Strategy of Denial, but it basically is, you know, the underpinnings of US strategy in the Indo-Pacific today, and potentially will be on steroids if we get a Trump 2024 presidential running. So the idea is there is so much complexity that I just don't think we can set a strategy that is targeted at being able to have an Australian Defence Force that is agile enough to win through a strategy of denial. It was just that kind of, there's so much grey space within on the sort of conflict to cooperation continuum. And I just felt as if the way that this strategy launched itself, and it, you know, 100 odd pages launched itself, was much more towards the end of the continuum that's looking at, you know, war is inevitable, which I don't think it is.
Could I just jump in on that, David? Because I think this points to something that's really crucial for understanding this document. You know, we've had 15, 20 years of government saying, oh, it's a more complex environment and we need to integrate and cooperate and whole of government strategies. And at times, a lot of that has genuinely overwhelmed the system in terms of trying to identify all of the significant areas. I think what Liz kind of rightly identifies is that in response to that, the 2023 DSR and now the NDS clearly say, well, defence's job is not to do everything. You know, explicitly, they're not doing a lot of the kind of natural disaster and other responses, but they are to help us solve five specific problems that we think are essential within this new environment. And these are the net assessment scenarios, which are still classified, but which the entire ADF focus is to be directed towards. And the government is making the bet that this new focus force can and must be able to address these five problems of our complex environment. And that's not everything to do with our security, but it's a judgment that if we can get these five things right, then we're making significant progress towards our security and our overall prosperity and well-being. And so I think recognizing the way that these are driving and shaping the response, that it is that targeted focus on these five scenarios, then helps explain what the real strengths of this document are, but also, I guess, some of the broader questions, given the document's focus on national defense, given the government's rhetoric about having the entire public and all areas of statecraft integrated into our broader security planning and processes.
I agree, Andrew. I think that this document, if we focus just on not all of the things, and ADF being, you know, responsible for delivering on all of the things, if we had had a 10-page max document that just featured around those five key priorities and how they sit within this concept of national defence, I mean, that would have ticked a lot of boxes for me. Anyway.
We've really just begun to discuss with that what I think is at the core of the document and what I was hoping to get out of this conversation. But if I can just step us back a little bit, and I think it's in the same sort of vein when we're talking about what is the purpose of the document, what's the objectives, who's it speaking to, I think that also provides some context on often why these documents are written the way they are and what struck me about whether it's defence white papers, defence strategic update, defence strategic review, all this sort of thing. They're caught in a bind where they have to be an unclassified document that can be provided to the public and to a wide audience to consume and understand, but they also then have a classified supporting, you know, sort of the fundamental version that drives what the department does, that's informed by intelligence assessment and strategic policy and scenarios and the like. How much are these documents driving at a public audience? How much are they driving at an internal audience? And I think that question to me shapes some of the structure, because you'd think the classified version may well have a lot more information that gets to some of these questions that we're raising and that answers some of them in different ways. And yet this is the public version we have to see. So they're not going to be that far apart. But do you think this almost sort of dual masters model, where they're trying to be an unclassified defense strategy, which is not entirely oxymoronic, but goes down that path, how much does that, the structure, the intention, how much does that shape what we see before us? Andrew, if you'd like to kick us off.
Thank you. So it's a fascinating question, and one I'm starting to get a bit of a sense of, because I've been lucky enough to be drawn in on a Department of Defense ANU project looking at the history of the defense white papers. And what's remarkable is that there's often a lot of overlap between kind of what the government's discussing internally and what they kind of present publicly when their white papers are released. And, you know, a lot of intelligence agents over the years have kind of come to similar conclusions that, you know, while there is a lot of important classified documents, the way that governments design their defense forces can be understood through open source materials and generally aligns with what is in the national media and the kind of the key blogs and sources like that. And so at that higher strategic level, there's not as much kind of contradiction or difference as I might have expected. Now, at times, Australia has approached this question in quite different ways, that we have the strategic basis papers after the Second World War through to the late 1980s, which were internal classified documents. We have the defense white papers from 76 through till the last kind of formal one was in 2016, but really there was the 2020 update, which are public declaratory documents. And in some ways, they are for quite different audiences. The classified ones tends to be more about here's the problems and threats we're facing, and here's our response to them. The white papers tended to have similar kind of essays about the region, but were much more focused on justifying to the public that we were efficiently using taxpayer dollars and that we were taking care of defense personnel. And at times when we have, you know, versions of the two documents that were released at similar periods, such as 75, 76, you can actually kind of compare very similar judgments, but very different areas of focus, because the white papers being public are much more declaratory. So I think that kind of shapes the way these documents are done. But with this document, I think it's notable that it is an update. And so the concern is much more about kind of what is the progress, what is the change, and the fact that we are kind of continuing so much of what's kind of going on, rather than kind of needing to be lots of different messaging for different audiences. Because I think that the trends were really set up in the prior Defence Strategic Review. And this being the first kind of cut of these new approaches is more about kind of implementing that and establishing the processes and saying, look, business is continuing, rather than a distinct message sending effort, as we might expect for defense white papers that governments kind of negotiate and authorize at specific times. This is now meant to be a more regular, updated, consistent process.
Any thoughts, Liz?
Yeah, Andrew makes fantastic points, but I think it is important to have, you know, a bit of a stock take to see how this document has been received. So first of all, in the strategic community, the Australian national sec, national security sector, we're obviously all vying to have our opinions heard. But, you know, no real alternatives have been offered. I'll make that point when it comes to, I guess, the kit and how much we're spending on it. That's problematic, but perhaps it's also a byproduct of just, you know, the Australian defence debate domestically writ large, right? But when it comes to the general community, in terms of, you know, the everyday Australian for which the ADF, you know, exists, it draws upon to arm itself through personnel, but also, you know, its mandate there is to protect Australians and Australian territory fundamentally. I think it's super important. So I'm down right now in Geelong with family, and I've asked five different people to read the NDS. And I printed off the strategy. I've passed it around. I've had no one go past page 10, right? So they simply do not understand it. It's not for lack of disinterest, which is probably, I guess, one concern that's levelled at Australian agency and national security debates. It's just, it's the complexity of what's actually written. And this, I think, the NDS, the public version that we're all kind of consuming and poring over, was a real opportunity to speak to the collective notion of bolstering agency and interest in our ADF and what it does and why it exists. But instead, I think we've kind of further isolated it. I also want to make a point that there's been quite a bit, unfortunately, I feel, grandstanding and the kind of politicization of the NDS. And we saw that in the launch of it, right, at the National Press Club. And I think that's also a huge opportunity we've lost. We've got no real bipartisan approach that's evident when it came to the NDS or any NSS futures. And I think that any of our defence strategic planning needs to be decadal. It needs to speak across the political divide. And that's, I don't think, been a core aim under this government. And interestingly, and I'll just finish on the third point of how it's been received, if we look to the international community, about 3-4 days ago, there was this really interesting piece in the Japan Times, and it spoke about the launch of the NDS. And quote, you know, Australia's defence activity will no longer be confined to its borders, end quote. Another quote was, the denial strategy will address threats further away, end quote. And I mean, understandably, they can be outtakes from our neighbours reading the strategy, but they were not key points that I took from reading the strategy. If anything, we were talking about being a smaller, you know, more more boutique force, which, you know, the ADF is a great force in that sense. But apparently, you know, our Japanese neighbours, at least those people that write op-eds in the Japan Times, thinks that we are going to be addressing threats further and further away from our shores.
That's a really interesting example of how it's received overseas, which is a point I was about to raise, actually, which is, you know, part of the role of these documents is also, I think, to sell a certain message to the international audience. It's not just to a domestic audience. It, you know, everyone sort of does the classic sort of pore over the document and sort of control F my country or control F my favorite sort of you know, alliance or partnership or what have you, and then from that discern the deep and secret meaning of the NDS for them. But that's a really interesting example of how that maybe hasn't quite gone as intended. But I think. And also on your point around the lack of bipartisanship, Liz, I think I might have a different position, and I think Andrew's written a little bit about this himself over time, so he might have some thoughts too. But it was very notable, and I agree, it was very notable that in the minister's launch he was quite overtly political, and I think sort of trying to head off some criticism which he was anticipating from either from sort of maybe not friendly media or from the opposition. But in some ways, I think it's actually a good thing that the government is not just doing what it thinks is going to be sort of acceptable to the opposition and vice versa, that we've obviously got a long tradition of broad bipartisanship within Australia in defence policy making, but I guess you could sort of perhaps contest that and say, well, where's that gotten us? If we're looking back over 5, 10, 20 years of largely similar defence white papers, almost identical force structures, well, does that bipartisanship actually lead to better outcomes, or does it lead to more status quo thinking? And I don't think we necessarily need to try and answer that now, but it's a good, I think, question for us all to ponder on, is the merits or otherwise of a bipartisan or not bipartisan approach. Andrew, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, look, I strongly agree. And, you know, I wrote back in 2017 when the coalition was in power, so my point is not a partisan one, but I think for the Australian public to engage with these debates, they need to see their political leaders arguing about it. It can't just be the preserve of the security community deciding what's right for the country, because at a fundamental level, this is all about what the country is actually willing to do, what they're willing to pay for. And if it's to be deterrence as our fundamental approach, then, you know, what are we going to be committed to? What are we going to be honor-bound to respond to such that an adversary will have to take it seriously when our leaders say we're doing X and you can't do Y, or there'll be a response? So I think it's actually a really good thing if we get political debate, because the essence of a democratic system is that it kind of finds new ideas, it finds better ideas through that debate. But, you know, I think Liz is right to highlight that, you know, if we are seeing a sudden change in the approach, and if it's not kind of clearly justified, if it's just kind of seen as a one-off, if it's just when these, you know, all kind of very important documents are released with the public service stamp of, you know, careful, serious work, and then the minister takes a few political pot shots, that's not really going to get us where we need to be. There needs to be strong political buy-in consistently talking about these topics, and that's how the system is supposed to work, rather than just standing behind or next to those in uniform and the authority that they have. So, you know, we do need to be careful here, as much as we do need a lot more of our politicians speaking and talking about these issues every day, because, you know, if it is to be national defence, the nation has to be involved. It can't just be the Defence Force.
100% agree with Andrew on that, but I'll take it one point further. And that's, if we're talking about national defence, I don't think it's suited to a national defence strategy. I think that's something that's suited to a national security strategy. I think they're two very different things. I think we are missing a national security strategy. To be honest, I kind of half expected a Taylor Swift kind of launch with a surprise launch of two double albums. But it really, the national defence strategy reads like that. It's half-baked across two documents. And David, you pointed out that at the start of the pod, in your intro, it reads as such. We've got fundamentally two documents and it's full of public service jargon. So, I just wonder in the delivery if it's fallen flat. That's not to say that I'm sure hours and hours of work and, you know, commitment has come into this from our public service and it's commendable, but at the end of the day, I'll go back to the point I opened with, which is, to what effect was the NDS meant to generate?
I think that's a really important point of clarification that I also was thinking would be good for us to sink our teeth into a bit, is this whole, I guess you might say, the strategy framework that this fits within, that it's not just a one-off document that exists at sort of the peak of the planning tree for the whole Australian government or security sector. It's meant to be a national defence strategy. And that's good and proper, but if we say look at the United States as a counterexample, they have on a quadrennial basis a national security strategy, a national defence strategy, and a national military strategy, which are all released publicly. Now, I think as Andrew was laying out earlier, we've had a traditionally more ad hoc approach to public strategic policy making in Australia, and that this move to the biennial cycle of a new NDS and a new integrated investment program and the associated documents, to me that is commendable, because I think there is merit in that, shall we say, continuous strategy making process. Much as we have continuous shipbuilding, I think we should have continuous strategy making. But it does feel to me like the NDS was trying to do too much, or rather the concept of national defence is trying to do too much, because it says, I believe I have the the quote in front of me, it describes as a new approach to Australia's defence, which is the concept of national defence, which is framed as a coordinated whole of government and whole of nation approach that harnesses all arms of national power to defend Australia and advance our interests. Now, in isolation, to me, that is clearly the aspiration of a national security strategy, not a national defence strategy. And defence has a role within that, and that's what the document then sets out to try and articulate what defence's role within that concept of national defence is. But it does seem a little bit, there are two different motivations, perhaps. And, the government to this point seemingly has, or governments of either stripe for that matter, have not indicated an intention to return to our one-off national security strategy from 2013, which I think really we should do a lot more research in, and it's something that I'm hoping to do a bit of research in myself to understand why that didn't succeed, because I think that's one of the challenges in implementing a national security strategy in a system like ours, where there isn't, say, the National Security Council, as in the US. We have a broad sweep of departmental secretaries and ministers who all have different equities that they would want to protect, and how you find someone that sits at the top of that tree and implements that policy, apart from perhaps an appointee who's personal to the Prime Minister and then acts with their imprimatur, I'm not sure. So I think I have reservations at a, you might say, technical level, not at a conceptual level of how that would work, but I think there is... It seems to me there's a necessity for expanding this concept of national defence more broadly and finding ways to incorporate, whether it's foreign affairs or home affairs or health, treasury, whomever else, into this bigger picture and how it fits together. Does that kind of align with how you were thinking, Liz?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, right? So the 2013 National Security Strategy, I did a little bit of research into that when I was formerly with Defence, and it was quite interesting to dig into the kind of launch speeches from Julia Gillard, then Prime Minister, but also, Kevin Rudd. It had legs. What happened? And I think the kind of internal discussions were no one wants to be held to account, much less public servants, like, let's be honest. But when it comes to these kind of pillars that you've just articulated in national defence, this coordinated whole of government, whole of nation approach to harnessing national power, that sounds great. Put that on a bumper sticker. Love it. But these are things, none of which the Department of Defence does well. It is big, it is slow, it is clunky. So we are setting up for failure if we're going to put the national defence construct on the shoulders of the Department of Defence. It sits across the whole government. But to do that, as I think we've kind of established, we need to be talking about national security strategy as well, and that kind of duality of the two planning documents. I also wanted to dig into further down the page that you've quoted when it talks about, what national defence is as a concept. There's this discussion, I think, of the tasking for the ADF specifically. And I mean, if you just read that list, we've got capacity to defend Australia, its immediate region, our economic connections, collective security of the Indo-Pacific, global maintenance of the rule-based order. I mean, how does a focused ADF, quote-unquote focused ADF, do all of these things? And this is where it comes into, I guess, more of the national security discussion, which is, what are our vital strategic interests? What are the costs for Australia if some of these have to fall to the wayside? And how are we prioritizing? So again, I feel as if there's two documents mixed in here in 100 pages.
Andrew, how does that sit with you?
Thanks. Look, I think Liz is right that there are quite divergent focuses and concerns listed within this document. And this goes back to the kind of two tiers idea that I mentioned earlier, which is that I think when I read it, there is a very clear sense of a couple of core strategic military problems in establishing what I've been calling archipelagic deterrence, that is, deterring really Chinese military aggression against Australia across our northern approaches. And there's a lot of clarity about the significance, the resourcing, and the importance of that task and what that task might be, even if we're not told what the five specific scenarios where that would play out will be. And then after that, there's a second tier, which is the things kind of going further north into the region, which we might term regional reassurance. And even though it's lumped under the umbrella of deterrence, it's a lot about kind of working with partners, about, you know, reassuring them that we're committed, about demonstrating our alliance bona fides. But there's no clarity or desire to explicitly target, you know, specific capabilities or specific missions within that, right? You know, this is not a document that says we'll go defend Japan or we'll go protect Taiwan or we will kind of participate in a Quad mission in the remote Indian Ocean. You know, it is the only area that is very explicit about what the ADF is to do is in that archipelagic tier across the northern approaches. Everything else, the document becomes much more vague and much more uncertain. And partly that's just because there's a lot greater range of possible options for the ADF across the, you know, as you move further away from the community, from our territories. But I think it also reflects some of the internal and external debates within Australia about, well, what should we be doing in that broader region and just how significant should it be? Now, we have all of this great talk about working with Japan, but should that actually be changing our force structure in notable ways? This document, like the DSR, like the 2020 update, explicitly says no, that we're designing our forces for that first archipelagic deterrence mission, and everything else has to kind of come from the forces designed for all of that mission. And that's generally been the way Australians have approached this, you know, over the last half century. It's very rarely only a few voices, Robert Hill in 2003, Tony Abbott a bit in 2014-15, who's tried to push a different way of thinking about the design and structure of Australian Defence Forces. And, you know, I've often tell my students at ANU that, you know, if you want to understand these documents, it can be just as useful to read them from the back to the front as it is to start from the front and then go to the back, because the force structure is where the priorities and the specific decisions, what's really seen as important, that's where they're decided, and often far more kind of clear in terms of what's significant and what isn't, as opposed to the opening essay, which has a lot more attempt to communicate messages to different audiences. So I think if you look at the force structure, there's a lot more clarity in a lot of that. The exception always being here AUKUS and the SSNs, you know, and how they would fit into some of these elements and the diversity of potential roles that they could be employed to.
We'll be right back.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
I think that that lack of specificity is one that I would hope would be addressed through a military strategy that sort of comes from this defence strategy, focusing much more on what the ADF is specifically going to be required to do and under what circumstances. But as much as I might like that to be provided in an unclassed version for us all to read, I suspect that that will be kept locked away for many years behind a secret classification that we won't be able to see. But I think maybe this is a good chance for us to get back into that conversation around deterrence and sort of taking the next step beyond national defence into specifically defence's role. And I'll just read another excerpt here from the NDS that gets to that point. So it says that Australia's defence strategy seeks to deter any actions that could lead to conflict, military coercion, or direct action against Australia or our interests. To focus defence planning on this objective, the government has adopted a strategy of denial. The strategy of denial aims to deter any conflict before it begins, prevent any potential adversary from succeeding in coercing Australia through force, support regional security and prosperity, and uphold a favourable regional strategic balance. Now, that's quite a dense little paragraph or a few sentences, but it strikes me as probably the conceptual heart of a lot of what the NDS is getting at. It's trying to draw these ideas together of deterrence, of denial, of preventing coercion and such. So to me, that's the core defence strategy embodied there. Now, could I ask you both to try and, as best possible, maybe articulate what that means in layman's terms? Like we hear these words like denial and deterrence and coercion and such, and I think we and others in our community might have a reasonable understanding of those from a sort of academic or historical perspective, but like what does this actually mean in practice? Or maybe, Liz, I'll start with you, and certainly from what you've been saying so far, you don't think it necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you think that it holds together and necessarily makes sense as a coherent structure. Is that a fair characterization?
I don't think it's resonating at all with the broader Australian community, and I think that's a problem. I think a straightforward way that I have been articulating the point of these 100 pages is essentially we've moved from an approach of we, ADF, will shape the environment conducive to our interests. We will deter any aggression threatening those interests, and we will have the capability to respond if need be. So that has been, I guess, the stock standard approach, first kind of articulated in our defence strategic update 2020. But what this new concept of national defence, the national defence strategy, has put on the table, it said, well, what we're going to do now is we're just going to move these priorities around because the pace of strategic change is such that we are potentially no longer, which I think is right, in a position to shape the environment that we exist within as much as we thought we could. So we will be focusing on our deterrence capability. We will then look to shape and obviously respond. So it's interesting because that flies completely at odds with our close partner New Zealand and their national security and defence strategy, in which they look at understanding, partnering and acting. I think that's more apt for a smaller power, and perhaps Andrew and I can get into that later, but I have problems about, you know, the articulation of Australia as a middle power. I think, you know, that's quite ambitious. I think that's also problematic because as small powers, I think we've got that agility to understand, to partner and to act. I think we've got some spaces in which we can shape, potentially respond is going to be in lockstep with our stronger partners. But deterrence is the big problem for me. And to have that as the feature of our national defence strategy, I think it is so reflective of a like 2010s period in which we thought we could, the Western, you know, liberal democratic grouping writ large, could shape the environment and could deter these new alignments from forming foundations and partnerships. But I think post 9/11 and the failed Russia reset with the West, you know, we know that we're not going to have a reset 3.0, 4.0, 5.0. This is a complete, you know, defined course for that relationship some two decades later. So the idea that deterrence is viable today, I'm less confident, and I think the weight of any measurable success when it comes to how our deterrence capability has gone sits anyway with our enemy or our competitor. So I'm not sure how we make deterrence itself a feature and a kind of the heart of our strategy. I don't think that that's setting us up for, you know, any sort of real competitive edge.
Andrew, what do you think on the matter?
So I'm much more supportive of deterrence at the heart of Australian thinking, in that I never quite understood what shaping or responding meant, whereas I think deterrence, it's fundamentally an empirical problem, right? Who do you want to deter? What do you want to deter from them? and or deter them from doing? And why do you think that your actions will be so objectionable, so costly to them, that they will actually change their mind? So it gives us something very clear to assess, to analyze, and to then hold the government and the ADF accountable for their capacity to do it, at least, you know, what seems measurable and likely outside of conflict. And as I look at it, there is a very clear sense in this document that we're very concerned about China undertaking kind of military coercion in the same way they do to Japan and Taiwan on a daily basis against Australia. And that could be much more hostile forms during a conflict or even during a war, potentially trying to change a key political decision by the Australian government. And within our northern approaches, given the distance, given the balance of forces, the advantage that defenders have, particularly given contemporary military technology, I think a plausible case can be made that, you know, we can aim for that goal and that we can have a serious kind of contribution that Beijing would have to take seriously and might change their decisions about, you know, could they coerce Australia in a way that would be useful to them? I think that makes sense. I think the challenge is when deterrence in this document is also then trying to carry the weight of almost everything else that we're attempting to do in the broader region. And it becomes a lot less clear. You know, the document has all of these references to Iran, to Israel-Palestine, to concerns in Ukraine, and kind of preventing any conflict and any adversary, and loses that specificity to it. What we're doing in deterrence at a broader regional scale is not designing Australian forces for, you know, Indo-Pacific deterrence. What we're doing really is working with the Americans. And in this light, I actually think that the 2021 AusMINS agreement, where we agreed to host significant US power projection facilities in Northern Australia, is probably going to be more significant for Australian security than the 2021 AUKUS agreement, which, you know, just focused primarily at the time on the nuclear submarine acquisition. And that's not really discussed very significantly in this document, or at least not kind of given the seriousness with which it probably deserves, given our focus on contributing to a regional balance of power, which will be primarily through, you know, involving the US. Where the kind of ADF is being focused is that immediate archipelagic region to our north and answering the five problems, the five scenarios that are going to largely operate in that area. And I think that's where kind of we have to be assessing, you know, how well the government is doing this, trying to hold them accountable for it, and trying to make assessments of, you know, is this document successful? We probably have to measure it against the criteria it's trying to establish, which is around those five scenarios. Now, I have a concern with some of the criticism and some of the kind of public takes that I've seen, you know, in the papers and others, that I think a lot of people are still judging this in the way that we looked at strategy kind of back in the 1990s, which is, you know, you've got to identify all of your broad principles and your values. And this isn't a document that does a lot of that. It doesn't have these great panaceas to democracy and, you know, the kind of world that we'd like to build. But also a lot of the kind of criticism in the papers has been about, oh, well, you know, we should indulge in a bit of retail therapy to make us feel better about a bad world. Ukraine has great FPV drones. Let's get some of those. You know, Israel has done well with the F-35 in protecting it from missiles. We should order another squadron. You know, unconnected to the very specific detailed problems that we really are going to be aligning the ADF to. And so it'd be nice to see kind of critics trying to meet this document a little bit more where it's aiming, so that we can have a better conversation about how well is it doing and is the government providing the resources and support that's going to enable the ADF to meet what it's expected of.
I think that point around specificity is one that also resonated with me as I was reading through it, is that I keep on feeling compelled to say, well, who are you deterring? What are you deterring them from? How are you deterring them? We just have, the term is thrown out there, somewhat just sort of tabled as if it stands on its own, as sort of it in itself is a solution. Well, if we're now deterrent, then that sort of solves our problems, when actually it just articulates a way of seeking to address a whole raft of problems. And perhaps this goes to some of your earlier points that you were making, Liz, around the challenge of how broad our strategy is, that I mean, if we're talking about geography, we've got a very large expanse of ocean and of land and of sky to protect and to deter attacks from. And if the document, as it says, also points out that now that the geography and distance no longer carries as much weight as it did before, and we're now, whether it's through cyber or space or long-range ballistic missiles and things, we're now at greater threat. We're now sort of within that range of potential adversaries. How do we resolve all of that without acting much closer to where the adversary is coming from? I mean, we're just the scope is so large. But I'll just quickly, as an interesting historical aside, take us back to the 2013 Defence White Paper, which makes some very similar points to what we're seeing now in the NDS. So it says, Australia's military strategy seeks to deter attacks or coercion against Australia by demonstrating our capability to impose prohibitive costs on potential aggressors and deny them the ability to control our maritime approaches. This requires a credible force with effective capabilities for sea and air control and denial, strike and power projection. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds remarkably similar to what we're talking about now, but from 2013. So how much has the debate really shifted? I think we've seen the bigger strategic assessments change, I guess, in terms of the trajectory in the region and what actors are doing. But it sounds like to me that the fundamentals of the strategy are much as they have always been, is that there's a historic sense of, or a recognition, you might say, within Australia's defence strategic planning community that there are inherent geographical considerations that have to be managed, and that there are ways that a power of our size, be that a middle, small, regional, choose your fighter power, how we might respond to that, and a strategy of deterrence and denial, I think is a reasonable one, but we just need a bit more detail on, you know, scenarios, who, what, when, where. And again, maybe that's the role for a military strategy separate to the defence strategy, I'm not sure. Do you have any thoughts on the matter, Liz?
Yeah, so I just think, broadly speaking, perhaps we as a community have kind of inadvertently militarized the concept of deterrence to the point of no return. So that's problematic for me. I kind of wonder how the concept of deterrence works when competition is not in the military realm, you know, and certain objectives are beneath the threshold. But on the point of the continuity and change in our defence planning and the assessments of the region, I think, you know, we've for some time now realised that our security is best ensured in lockstep with the US. You know, this is a country that has, broadly speaking, similar values and interests and kind of an end goal to what the Australian community would expect of our defence force. So it makes sense that we have become, you know, again, once more, this isn't new to history for Australia, a forward operating base for the US. And that's what the sort of northern approaches and our Northern Territories development has looked like for the last decade or so. So I'm not sure some of the public commentary that's kind of, you know, drilled down, as Andrew pointed out, drilled down into us becoming, you know, a vassal state of the US. It's like, well, that ship sailed decades or so ago. Have you not seen what we have been doing? It's not necessarily a bad thing. And this is where I guess our Pillar One plans for AUKUS SSNs is so critical, because it's our opportunity, if we can pull it off with the UK and with the US, to show that, you know, we have this sovereign capability. So yeah, proof will be in the pudding. Let's see.
Andrew, do you have some follow-up thoughts?
Yeah, look, if I can just push back, I guess a little bit, in that I think it's remarkable within this document how much it emphasises the importance of Australian sovereignty. You know, there's some quite full-throated assessments about, particularly tied to the nuclear submarines, but also broadly that, you know, Australia doesn't host foreign military bases. And that is true. And I think, you know, a lot of the debate over many years in Australia has blurred the distinctions, which for the Australian government have often been very important. You know, the US has had far greater latitude and involvement and far less oversight in its facilities in Germany, in Britain, in Japan, than it has in Australia. And Australia has not hosted US forces other than kind of a brief period during the Second World War, and certainly not kind of extensive US bases. And behind the scenes, and, you know, if you read the kind of history of Australian operations during the Cold War that Peter Edwards did and things, there's extensive debates between the Australians and the Americans and great concerns about preserving Australian sovereignty. And I think that's always been the case. I think Australians have always been very concerned about sovereignty. And that's what makes the 2021 Osman Agreement so historic, because the government said, okay, we're actually going to start to trade some of that. We're actually going to start to give some of that up and allow consideration about, say, hosting US long-range bombers, something that the US had floated quite publicly in 2015 and 2016, and both Abbott and Turnbull and then even Morrison quickly raced to the media and said, look, we're not doing that. We don't host US forces, foreign forces that could kind of strike other countries. In 2021, we said, we're going to start to look at this and we're going to start to consider how this might work within a broader consideration of our framework and I think of our sovereignty and considerations there. So I think that is really important and something that, you know, our kind of quick, oh, you know, Australia's always followed the US, ha, 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 assessments that you often see in the kind of popular press just haven't missed how significant the shifts are, which, you know, it shows just A, how concerned Australia is about what's going on, but also in light of the upcoming US election, something that, you know, this document doesn't reference, does leave us really badly exposed for, you know, that increased dependence and that increased kind of reliance upon the United States acting in ways that we would like them to act. And so I think there are a number of big questions there that the government is going to have to publicly address and ideally does so before the election. You know, it can't be something that they kind of, after Trump's elected, if that happens, turn up and say, oh, we're all surprised by this and we're all trying to understand what's happening. No, it needs to be much more front and center, given how important that role is and trying to set some boundaries and conditions for that potential environment. I think that would be a much better way to be square with the public. Otherwise, there is a risk of that kind of cynicism about these topics kind of rebounding against, you know, what's being done and people becoming much more concerned than they perhaps should be about, you know, what could come from all of this.
So obviously one of the requirements of being sort of academics and researchers as we are is to spend a lot of time digging into the internal consistencies and logics of these documents and trying to explain them for a wider audience. So I think that's something that we've hopefully done successfully, and we'll let the listeners determine that for themselves, I suppose. But maybe just mindful that as we're getting close to time, what you were talking about there, Andrew, and I think part of the nature of this conversation also gets back to some of, Liz, your remarks at the beginning around communicating these ideas to the public. And I think that's, for me, probably the most important takeaway for us all in this conversation and for people within our community is to not just do the sort of the day after or the week after, in this case, assessments of these national defense strategies or white papers or what have you, but really use them as the yardstick against which we measure the government's performance on these topics. They've set that out for themselves. They've laid out what they want to achieve. Now we need to make sure that they are doing so in a manner that's consistent with what they've articulated. So whether that's a more extensive conversation that we could have around deterrence and around denial and these sort of these questions and whether they are achievable for a power such as Australia, but also I think it points to the necessity of governments of all flavors to spend a lot more time communicating these ideas to the public. It's not just a one-off. It's not just we do a nice release and then it just sort of rolls on. But particularly in an area like defense, at least in my opinion, there's a real impetus for governments to explain their strategic logics, to explain what they're asking of their people, whether that's in terms of personal commitment or tax and resources and things, that we're talking about a huge amount of money and the space we work in it's one of the most consequential arms of government. It has the potential to reshape the future of our entire country. So we need to take that very seriously. And I think then also translating that into parliament. I mean, I'd love to see a much more extensive set of debate between between members of parliament on the floor about defence strategy and policy, and not just doing it through sort of through op-eds or through sort of that one way formal conversation. But I won't get too ahead of myself there, but I just thought, as a way of summing up, maybe that sense of communication that we're trying to play our part in is one that members of government could take up as well. But just as we finish, for both of you, perhaps I might ask whether you have any just quick, interesting, noteworthy details that you thought came out of the NDS that we haven't talked about, that you might just sort of throw away as a quick one for people to think about as we finish the podcast today. Liz, how about I start with you?
Yeah, so I might just pop on my army wife hat for a moment here. People, obviously, critical component of delivering the national defence ambitions. But when we're looking at raising, training and sustaining an ADF, we need to think broader. And the idea that a $50,000 retention bonus is what military families like myself are going to be swayed by, you know, that's not realistic. There is such a sense of duty and commitment to defending Australia and fighting for our country that I think is a missed opportunity in terms of the government and the defence, the Department of Defence, really not trying to dig into that more and look at, you know, how do we cultivate a sense of duty in the next generation?
Andrew, any final thoughts from you?
Look, I was quite struck by the sentence on geography that you mentioned earlier, that, you know, geography has lost a lot of its kind of military advantages, and that, you know, we need to kind of realize just how much close we are to kind of contemporary conflicts. And it made me actually think of a line that I read a number of years ago, and I'll quote it and then I'll tell you the source, that, quote, "There was a time not long since when it was confidently maintained that Australia was outside the area of the world's conflicts. That comfortable outlook has long since passed away." That was Alfred Deakin in 1907. We've been saying Australia is on the front line, and, you know, we can't just rely on geography for a very long time. But geography still fundamentally matters. You know, ask the people of Ukraine, does geography matter depending on where they are in the country? And you'll see absolutely. In fact, if anything, it is becoming harder to move, because as soon as you move in a military sense, you can be identified and you can be targeted. And so it's notable that our language is still, oh, we're in this kind of post-geography world, and yet a lot of our specific decisions actually are very focused on a very core part of geography, are actually much more explicit about the importance of geography. And it'd be nice to start to see our kind of rhetoric start to catch up with that and not fall back into these truisms about, you know, technology obliterates geography.
Well, I've just got a couple of quick hits that I'll tack on the end here as well. First of which is the promise to establish a new Joint Statutory Committee on Defence, which is a new parliamentary body, which will be good to see what scope that has. Also, there's only a single passing mention of the Quad, which I would say is interesting, given it gets a lot more focus within DFAT's remit, and given the international media's focus on the Quad as a allegedly nascent Asian NATO, I think we can probably put those rumours to bed even more conclusively now. There's no mention of additional AUKUS Pillar 2 members, as has been in the media discussion of late, so that's another separate conversation there. My personal favourite small multilateral security organization, the Five Power Defense Arrangements, gets a couple of paragraphs as well. So good to see the FPDA getting a Guernsey here in the NDS as well. But Elizabeth Buchanan, Andrew Carr, thanks so much for joining us on the National Security Podcast.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.